Michał Tyszkiewicz, who lived from 1826 to 1897, was a count from one of the most famous and richest families of the Grand Duchy of Lithuania. Some of the Greek vases and Egyptian sculptures in the world's most famous museums are still named after him today. How did this happen, and what is the connection between this nobleman of the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, born in Lohoysk, educated in Vilnius, who spoke Polish, and these objects of ancient art? Michał Tyszkiewicz is an avid hunter, organizing hunts for the visiting Russian Tsar in Lithuania, and hunting on his own estate or with friends in other countries. Meanwhile, on the other side of Europe, in Marseille, it is already common for wealthy people to get on a steamer and travel, for example, to Egypt. Michał Tyszkiewicz, a man of broad education and outlook, also started to organize such a trip, keeping up with the fashion of the time.
From the notes of diary of Michał Tyszkiewicz. On the 13th of October, 1861, I boarded the steamer Indus in the port of Marseille, bound directly for Alexandria, intending to stop for a few hours at La Valletta in the island of Malta. This beautiful screw steamer of 300 horsepower belongs to the Messagerie Imperial Company and is one of the best and fastest ships of them. I got a three-bed cabin. One of them was occupied by Dr. Duke Jagiel, who was to travel with me to Egypt and Nubia. The other two beds stayed free, as they were too short for me. I had to spread my beddings on the ground.
Egyptologist Tadas Rutkauskas talks about this trip and Michał Tyszkiewicz.
That trip to Egypt changes him completely. If he travels there as a passionate hunter, he returns as a true archaeologist and collector.
I got into the carriage of Mr. Dufault, my young traveling companion. As a polite resident of Alexandria, he wanted to introduce me to the city's attractions and its surroundings. We started by visiting the so-called Cleopatra's Needles. These are two gigantic obelisks standing in the dirty yard of an Arab. One of them is already laying down, and more than half of its weight has sunk into the ground. And the other one, which is still standing, amazes with its greatness and the hieroglyphs of excellent work with which they are inscribed. The obelisk was gifted by the viceroy to the English government, but England still leaves it in place, as the cost of transporting such a huge block would be unlimited. A few Arab children, seeing foreigners around us, shouting in different voices, "Bakshish, give me something, sir."
Michał Tyszkiewicz describes his journey in detail in a two-part diary, most probably after his return to Lithuania in the spring of 1862, based on his memories. The first part, heavily edited, was published in Paris in 1863, in Polish. The original manuscripts of both parts were discovered only in 1992 by Andrzej Niwiński, the best researcher of Michał Tyszkiewicz, in the Raczyński Library in Poznań.
The description of the trip at that time is very, very interesting. But at the same time, Mikołaj Tyszkiewicz describes not only his excavations and travels, but also nature, hunting, and the people he met at that time, describes the customs of that time in Egypt. This is not just a simple travel diary, but also a very interesting book about the Egyptian traditions and customs at that time.
At 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm ready to hunt. Mr. Dufault accompanies me. We are surrounded by thick fog, so we could see only a few steps ahead. A few minutes later, we left the city and entered the ruins of the old city of Benho. Many antiquities were found in the excavation of the foundations of the palace, but under Abbas Pasha, whose government was entirely indifferent to the antiquities of Egypt, those splendid and rich finds became the spoils of a few peasants who melted down the gold and silver articles and sold the other, less valuable ones cheaply to foreigners. The land of Egypt, in spite of so many years of search, is still, so to speak, filled with the most interesting and beautiful monuments of the ancient art of the ancient Egypt, Greeks, and Romans.
We look at this diary from the perspective of today. We try not to take a colonialist view, not to underestimate the people of that time too much. Mykolas Tiškevičius also tried to do that. He does not rush to criticize everything, he does not rush to look down on everything, but this was determined by his high education.
Mihail Tiškevič went to Egypt very prepared. Not only did he carry hunting rifles and dogs, but he also traveled with and read books on Egyptian culture and customs, and had a hieroglyphic textbook by Jean-François Champollion. Even today, we feel that this helps him to maintain a reasonably respectful relationship with the local people, not an easy task for the imperial-minded Europeans of the time.
Another reason is where he comes from. He's not French, not English, he comes from Lithuania, which at that time was part of the Russian Empire. So he understands what the situation is, and therefore looks a little differently towards the locals themselves.
At the time, Frenchman Auguste Mariette was responsible for the archaeological excavations throughout Egypt. They are forbidden to everyone else, only done by people appointed by Mariette.
What is really surprising is that Mykolas Tiškevičius is received as a very important person when he arrives in Egypt. He arrives in Alexandria and is immediately greeted by very important people in Egypt. And they even arrange him a meeting with the governor of Egypt, Mohamed Said Pasha, the most important person in Egypt at that time. When Mykolas Tiškevičius arrived, he met with the most important people in Egypt at that time, and this was truly impressive.
Under these exceptional circumstances, Mihail Tiškevič is granted a firman, official permission guaranteeing assistance throughout the country, as well as the opportunity to carry out archaeological excavations at several temples.
At that time, the Suez Canal was already under construction in Egypt, which would be completed in 1869. Thus, it opens after Mykolas Tiškevičius has already left, and both Egypt and the French engineers who are working on the construction of the canal are facing major problems. Lack of money, lack of funds, lack of human hands to dig the canal. And perhaps Mykolas Tiškevičius, as a representative of a large and important family, a really rich man, although he had not yet inherited the majority, was perhaps expected to contribute financially to the construction of the Suez Canal. Maybe that's why all roads were open to him and such a huge help was given.
However, the permission granted to Mihail Tiškevič to excavate covers only certain areas. The most important objects, the mummy sarcophagi with the most interesting artifacts, are not there. Such finds are only possible in the Valley of the Kings, in the area reserved by Auguste Mariette.
There are certain Egyptians that appear and say, "We will fix everything, of course, for a certain reward. We will find a place where you can dig at night." The relevant people will be paid not to say anything. And Mykolas Tiškevičius succumbs to this temptation. And as he writes in his diary, his conscience pricks on something. He understands that it is not legal, that it is not good. But the tendency to collect antiquities wins. And one night he starts digging and finds an untouched tomb with mummies, with various tombs, sarcophagi. Mummies are then unwrapped, various golden things are found. So in the end it paid off to take such a huge risk, finding interesting things that have survived both in the National Museum in Warsaw and in Paris.
From the notes of diary of Michal Tiškevič. Mr. Lavison, the Russian vice consul, last year had a firman issued by the viceroy authorizing him to carry out archaeological searches in Egypt. He sent a messenger early this morning inviting me to come to him at noon to witness the opening and unwrapping of the mummies. In the middle of the courtyard lay three mummies in wooden sarcophagi, a human face and hands executed in the relief carving technique, shine in vivid colors and adorn the outer sarcophagus, which bears a short inscription in hieroglyphs.
Let's understand that such semi-legal or even illegal excavations were an opportunity for the local Egyptians themselves to have an income, to help themselves to their lives. Participating in excavations was one of the ways to get legitimately paid. But at the same time, let's not forget that during excavations, it was possible to steal something and to try to sell it later.
The strong and aromatic smell of myrrh, with which the bodies of mummies are embalmed, spread through the yard and could even be felt in the street. Soon, almost all the European consuls arrived and several wealthy residents of Cairo eagerly came to participate in the opening of the coffins that had hidden the bodies of dead people for several thousand years. A few men with carpenter's tool lifted the lid of the sarcophagus, and when the chest was opened, we saw another inside quite similar to the first wooden sarcophagus. Only the hieroglyphs of the latter one were different. Both chests were made of sycamore wood and are so well preserved that they look as if they were made yesterday. The color of the paint has not even faded, especially the faces carved in wood with great talent have retained a surprising freshness of color.
Michal Tiškevič describes the artifacts in his diary. He also mentions that more extensive descriptions and drawings are provided in a separate appendix. However, the appendix either did not survive or did not even exist. It is also difficult to say exactly how many objects Michal Tiškevič brought back to Europe. Andrzej Niewiński thinks it may be around 800, of which around 400 have survived to this day. Michal Tiškevič brought back a variety of sarcophagi, papyruses, jewelry, sculptures, amulets and scarabaeus. Some of them are simply souvenirs for friends and relatives. Some are donated to the Vilnius Museum of Antiquities, the first museum in Lithuania, founded by Michal Tiškevič's uncle, Eustachy Tiškevič.
Ir grįžęs į Paryžių, jisai nuneša savo tuos atvežtus suvenyrus.
When he returns to Paris, he takes his collected objects, excavated and purchased, to the Louvre. He shows what he brought back to the director of the Louvre Museum and the head of the Egyptian department. He wants to receive praise, some envy, and so on. The representatives of the Louvre say that certain things are really very interesting and that they would be happy to buy them. And Tiškevičius says that you don't buy it. I'll just just give it to you all. And so about 200 objects that came from Egypt are donated by Tiškevičius to the Louvre Museum. And so the name of Mykolas Tiškevičius is engraved as one of the most important donors of the museum.
Mykolas Tiškevičius, jo vardas yra išgraviruotas tų garsiųjų donatorių muziejų kaip vienu iš svarbiausių. Ir taip, tie apie 200 objektų.
In terms of numbers, both the Louvre and the Vilnius Museum of Antiquities were similar, but in terms of quality, the best finds went to the Louvre. This angered Mykolas Tiškevičius' uncle Eustache, Lithuania's first archaeologist and founder of the Vilnius Antiquities Museum. However, Mykolas Tiškevičius apparently understood well that the objects in Vilnius would only be exhibited antiquities, as there were no Egyptology researchers there. He foresaw that in the Louvre, the exhibits would have more value for scholars and for science. Now some of the artifacts in Warsaw went there through Mykolas Tiškevičius' cousin from Lohoisk and so survived. A few are in London, a few more in Boston, and scattered in other museums around the world.
When the second sarcophagus was opened, we found the third and last chest in it. It was very difficult to open that third canvas chest, so a wide and long opening had to be cut with a chisel next to the body to remove it. Finally, the body was removed and placed on the table. Wrapped in yellowed canvas bands, he looked like a swaddled doll. With the permission of the master of the house, I started winding canvas ribbons myself. The smell of myrrh became so strong that some spectators began to feel dizzy. After unrolling a dozen cubits of ribbon from the waist, I suddenly saw seven scarabs, the undersides of which were covered with hieroglyphs inscriptions.
Iš kitos pusės, gal ir gerai, kad...
On the other hand, maybe it's good that those objects got into the Louvre, because the Vilnius Museum of Antiquities itself will be closed after the 1863 uprising.
Šimtai tų įvairiausių objektų ir taip pat apie šimtą...
Hundreds of various objects, the exact number is hard to say, donated by Mykolas Tiškevičius went to Moscow. Later, some of them, which were in private collections, perished during the First World War, so it is not clear which of those objects, if they had come to Lithuania, would have survived until now.
Each beetle had a hole from head to tail. The beetles were strung on a thin string that encircled the body along with the canvas ribbon that still had a lot to unroll. When I lifted the string with scarabs to show to the audience, the string had already completely rotten, fell into pieces so the scarabs were viewed separately. One of them, the most important, was made of gold. The two next to it are made of enamel and surrounded by gold thread. And the remaining four are made of stone. Mr. Lavison was so kind and generous to give me all the things I had discovered in undressing the mummies with my own hands as a commemoration of such an interesting meeting.
And although Mykolas Tiškevičius had a good archaeological sense, his descriptions from the finds focus only on the objects themselves, not on the archaeological context in which they were found. This makes it difficult to call his activity in Egypt scientific or academic. In the European context, his contribution to Egyptology is, one might say, non-existent. He did not discover anything that actually changed anything.
But let's not forget that Mykolas Tiškevičius' passion for archaeology is just beginning after his trip to Egypt.
On his return from Egypt to Paris, where he was already living at the time, Mykolas Tiškevičius' family relations deteriorated. He fell in love with a Parisian dancer, Juliette Debout, which led to his separation from his wife, Maria Radvilaitė. Mykolas Tiškevičius began to spend part of his life in Italy, first in Naples, then in Rome.
Roma tuo metu yra ir
After the unification of Italy, Rome became the center politically. But at the same time, it also became the city where the trade of antiquities found in Italy takes place. And not only Italian, but also Greek, Etruscan, and other most diverse ones from the entire Mediterranean basin.
As he grew older, Michał Tyszkiewicz was plagued by rheumatic pains, and his archaeological activities came to a halt. After the divorce, he lost, or rather gave up, a lot of property. Under these circumstances, the buying and selling of the collection became his main income, and Michał Tyszkiewicz himself became a central figure among collectors and researchers of ancient art and antiquities of the time.
Ir tų paskutinių 25 metų...
Over the last 25 years, he has amassed an enormous and impressive collection of classical, Greek, and Roman works of art.
Tyszkiewicz became friends and colleagues with Wilhelm Fröner, one of the best connoisseurs of ancient art at the time and artistic advisor to the Louvre, who worked together on his collection and published a catalogue of the collection.
Po Mykolo Tyszkiewicz's mirties,
after the death of Mykolas Tyszkiewicz in 1898, a catalogue of his collection appeared the following year. That collection was then auctioned off and spread around the world. Now, around 30 museums in the world have objects that once belonged to Mykolas Tyszkiewicz. And in general, Mykolas Tyszkiewicz is one of the greatest and most famous collectors of the second half of the 19th century.
Wilhelm Fröner wrote that if Michał Tyszkiewicz's collection had not been donated or sold, it would have been the largest collection of ancient art at the time. The Goethe-Schiller archive in Weimar contains 450 letters from Tyszkiewicz to Fröner. They deal with purchases, diplomatic niceties, gifts and various research matters. For Michał Tyszkiewicz, his home and his collection were not merely a source of personal pride over others, but were open to academics and their research. In this way, Michał Tyszkiewicz's contribution to the study of classical art becomes very significant.
Mykolas Tyszkiewicz, taip, jis yra garsiausias kolekcionierius, bet
Mykolas Tyszkiewicz is the most famous collector, yes. But over time, he also becomes a scientist. Why does he become a scientist? Well, life itself forced him to do it.
Puikiai suprato, kad jeigu tu nori būti kolekcininkas, jeigu nori su...
He understood very well that if you want to be a collector and collect a truly valuable collection, you must understand what are you collecting, know it well, and be able to distinguish fakes from the originals. And one of the most important objects he collected were gems, carved gems and other stones from antiquity. And one of the first sets he acquired was a vast collection of gems, which turned out to be largely fakes. But it was a very good lesson for him. So now we can finally understand why certain antique vases are named after Michał Tyszkiewicz.
Turime tokią labai gražią graikišką vazą, kuri nėra priskirta.
There is a very beautiful Greek vase, which is not yet attributed to any known artist. That is why it is known as Tyszkiewicz's vase. We also have a very beautiful Egyptian sculpture, and although the name is known, it is still called Tyszkiewicz's sculpture. Or there are also various seals, which are called Tyszkiewicz's seals.
Most of the research on Michał Tyszkiewicz's life and work is carried out by Polish scholars. This is mainly due to the linguistic aspect, since Michał Tyszkiewicz's life was not connected with the present territory of Poland. In general, the towns of the region, which were Michał Tyszkiewicz's home, such as Lahojsk, Vilnius and Gorodok, eventually drifted away from him.
Ir tą vėlgi neturime pamiršti, kad didžioji gyvenimo...
Again, we must not forget that most of Mykolas Tiškevičius' life was spent not in Lithuania or Poland, but in Europe. Mykolas Tiškevičius perfectly understood the political situation in Lithuania after returning from Egypt. Even then, before the uprising, the clouds were gathering. He understood that perfectly well. But from that political situation also follows a complicated cultural situation. And perhaps over time, those contacts do indeed fade. There is evidence, Mariola Kazimierczyk found it, that there were many spies in the Russian Empire who supervised the nobility of the Polish diaspora abroad. And we can compare it with the present times. So Mykolas Tiškevičius was then removed from one of the lists of people under surveillance by one of the spies, because he completely cut off relations and did not delve into politics. But it gave him the opportunity to be what he wanted and to devote his life to various antiquities.
Mariola Kazimierczak, Andrzej Niwiński and Aldona Snitkowienia are the best researchers who dedicate their lives to Michał Tiszkiewicz. The story of Michał Tiszkiewicz in this episode is told by Tadas Rutkauskas. The podcast was written by Martina Szulskutje, narrated by John Beecham, and was produced by Free Range Productions in Warsaw with assistance from the Nara Collective in Vilnius.